All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. Next on the show is Dr. Gareth Porter. He's a historian and a journalist. Writes for Inter Press Service. We rerun every bit of that at antiwar.com/Porter. Welcome back, Gareth. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining us today.
Yep, I'm glad to be here.
All right, well, you got a great new piece here, and this is a dead horse that I never get tired of beating on, so go ahead and tell us a story. Evidence of 2002 Taliban offer damages myth of Al-Qaeda ties.
Well, you know, I don't know if that title really does this story justice, because it seems to me that this is really potentially the opening wedge in a bigger story about how the whole Afghanistan war was entirely unnecessary. Had the U.S. government been even the slightest bit sensitive to the personal need to give the former Taliban officials, or the people who had been in high positions in the Taliban government before it was overthrown in 2001, assurances of personal security when they were apparently offering to come back and live in peace in the U.S. supported, U.S.-sponsored political system that was being set up in Afghanistan. It's an extraordinary story because it makes it clear that the people that we've been treating as though they were sort of minor league Al-Qaeda terrorists were really having very little, nothing in common with Al-Qaeda. In fact, were much closer to the kinds of people who were in the newly formed Afghan government than Al-Qaeda. In other words, their basic political instincts were clearly very different from what is being has been attributed to them over the years.
Well, you know, I'm trying to find, I'm flipping through the pages here, trying to remember the name of a guy that I interviewed, I think in December, November, and he had a piece that was based on first of all, I've interviewed Anand Gopal on this same subject.
Yeah.
I know he's part of your story. But
yeah.
I interviewed this other guy. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. I'm flipping through it trying to find
it. Was it Alex Strick von Lynchhoffen? Because he was another...
Well, here's the story. The story was, I believe it was Seton Hall, through the Freedom of Information Act, got a pile of documents of the State Department's dealings with the Taliban in the first part of 2001, before the September 11th attack, and how the Taliban were just obviously, completely and totally desperate to figure out a way to get rid of Osama bin Laden, and they basically weren't even really trying to even save face. They just wanted to get rid of the guy before the war even happened. And then, so then, this is where your story picks up, is after the war did start, because they wouldn't take yes for an answer before the war, then they wouldn't take yes for an answer again.
Let's come back to that pre-September 11th period, and this is alluded to in my story, but not in any detail. This is a bit complex because, as Alex Strick von Lindschotten and his co-author, Felix Kuhn, point out in their latest paper, which is the occasion for this story that I've written, the Taliban regime was, the leadership, political leadership, was divided in their view on what to do about bin Laden. And you're talking about that early 2001 period when there was a very strong faction within the Taliban regime which was ready to say, get rid of bin Laden, no ifs, ands, or buts, no conditionalities, just get rid of him, figure out a way to do it. They were quite determined about that. And on the other hand, apparently there was a hesitation on the part of Mohammed Omar, the spiritual political leader of the Taliban, although he held no government position, on the question of bin Laden, because apparently he had no real desire to keep bin Laden in Afghanistan. In fact, he was quite miffed about bin Laden's behavior and would prefer to get rid of him, but he was afraid of losing the support of his few Islamic allies. And that meant Saudi Arabia in particular, and of course Pakistan. And so this is really a part of the story that deserves to be further developed. The dependence of the Taliban on the assistance and friendship of some external Islamic countries, specifically Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, was very, very important in the decision by Mullah Omar to go against this very strong faction within the Taliban that just wanted to get rid of bin Laden regardless of the cost. And so neither of the two factions clearly were really sympathetic to what bin Laden was, which we now know what he was trying to do. In fact, they were quite out of sympathy with him and wanted to find a way to deal with the issue so that they wouldn't so that the regime wouldn't be hurt. But they had different views of what the costs and benefits of different courses of action were. So that brings me then to the situation that existed after 9/11. By that time, the other faction had been weakened by the death. That is, the faction that was really out and out ready to just get rid of bin Laden regardless of the cost had been weakened by the death of its leader, and that meant that the cautious approach still prevailed and did so in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And when the United States began its bombing then, it's clear, and I've written about this, maybe I didn't write about it, but I intended to write about it, the Taliban did in fact reconsider, the regime reconsidered that question and came out with a different posture in mid-October. They were prepared to send bin Laden to Saudi Arabia to be dealt with by a panel of Islamic judges from three Islamic countries, which was a new position because previously they had said they wanted to see some evidence of bin Laden's guilt. And this was a position that said, forget the evidence, we're ready to turn him over to an Islamic a body in a foreign country. So clearly they were moving in that direction of getting rid of bin Laden. They were ready to do it. And again, as you say, the Bush administration had no interest. In fact, they wanted their war by that time. And we now understand that the reason they wanted the war with Afghanistan so badly was that they wanted to get rid of the regime so that they could then justify moving on, of course, to their real interest, which was to invade Iraq.
In other words, to say, we did a successful regime change here, and now let's do it again. Is this one more talking point?
Really, Scott, I think it was more the necessity to satisfy the powerful popular desire or demand for revenge against the Taliban, who, of course, were being blamed for the 9/11 attacks. Basically, the White House felt that they had no choice.
Well, wasn't it even Tony Blair that said, at least, please, invade Afghanistan first, and then they'll do Iraq?
Exactly.
It's going to look really bad.
Yeah, I mean, they had no real enthusiasm for what was going on, you know, in Afghanistan, but they had to do it in order to justify doing anything more. They couldn't simply, you know, after 9/11, they couldn't simply attack Iraq without having gone into Afghanistan.
Sweep it all up, things related and not, as soon
exactly.
as we can.
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember right, maybe even before the PNAC crew wrote their letter to George Bush saying if he doesn't take on Iraq and Hezbollah, then it's not a real war on terrorism and they'll all turn against him and all that. William Safire had a piece that, at least in the Austin American Statesman, the title ran as the Big Mo, short for momentum. And it just said, everybody's on your side, just do it now, kill them now, and forget the UN, and forget, you know, anything. Just start launching the strikes tonight, Mr. President. You'll get away with it, I promise. We at the New York Times will help you. All right, wait. Hold it right there. It's Gareth Porter, everybody. Antiwar.com/Porter. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Gareth Porter, independent historian and journalist. Find what he writes at antiwar.com/Porter. Now, Gareth, go ahead and if you need to elaborate any more about the willingness of the Taliban to cooperate with the United States, before or after September 11th, please feel free. And then I can ask you questions about where we are now and how we got here from there.
Yes, I would like to go back to the essence of this story again, because, you know, in the first minute, I think, of the program, I didn't really go ahead and state the basic facts of the new story, which are that both Anand Gopal and now Alex Strickland-Lindschoten and Felix Kuhn, in a new paper published yesterday, have documented the fact that the Taliban political leadership meeting in Karachi, Pakistan, in 2002, made a decision among themselves that they would be prepared to return to Afghanistan and live under the new political regime there, the political system there, provided that they were given personal assurances of security. And that furthermore, what we know from these same sources, that the Taliban leadership, having been essentially rejected in terms of their request for the assurance of personal security to go back in 2002, continued in 2003 and 2004 to negotiate or to talk with representatives of the new Afghan government about the same issue, about the possibility of their returning in return for getting these assurances of personal security and not being arrested, sent to a dungeon, and put away for the rest of their lives or something. And again, in both of those cases, apparently they sent delegations to Kabul to talk with the new Afghan regime of Hamid Karzai, and this was apparently has been confirmed by representatives of the president's office, of Karzai's office, that they did discuss this, and we are very clear that it was not Karzai's desire, but the desire of the United States that this initiative be quashed. The United States government simply refused to provide the necessary assurances of safety, personal safety, to the Taliban representatives, and so the entire initiative or a set of initiatives went for naught. But what it shows is that there was a real not just a possibility, but that it was basically handed over to us on a silver platter, that the Taliban movement would cease to exist, you know, as an opposition, armed opposition movement, and would become part of the legitimate political system within Afghanistan, presumably representing, you know, a variant, but not a profoundly violently opposing variant of the politics of the former Mujahideen who were part of the regime. And there were a number of them, of course, who joined the Afghan government in that period.
Well, Anand Gopal, the Christian Science Monitor, former Christian Science Monitor reporter, I guess freelance journalist he is, that you cite in part in this article, he said on this show that, and I think in his work, that these are the very leaders of the rebellion against the American puppet government right now.
Right.
That 100,000 soldiers are fighting the very same names on the list.
Yes, it was that entire generation of senior Taliban officials who then, having been essentially turned down in an offer to live in peace within Afghanistan, waited and watched and found that the situation there in Afghanistan was such as to really give them an opportunity, and in fact to call them back to the role of armed opposition, because really it was in essence a situation in which a lot of people were demanding the help of the Taliban to essentially protect their interests from warlords who took power in the provinces of Afghanistan after 2001. And who clearly abused their power and, in fact, were physically abusive of many local populations. And that's why, essentially, the Taliban were given the opportunity and, indeed, given a summons by many of these local populations to come back and support them against the abuses of these new warlord officials.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, during the worst time of the Iraq War, Afghanistan was the forgotten war. It was compared directly to Korea in the way we just pretend to not care about that one too much. And the reason that was pretty much, you know, possible was because it was a pretty low-level war compared to what was going on in Iraq. And now all of a sudden, over the last couple of years, they've replaced each other. I saw a headline yesterday, Iraqis, meaning, I guess, our puppets fear, they are the forgotten war now. The Taliban, the opposition, the armed opposition in Afghanistan has really gained strength over these last few years. And, you know, I guess I could play devil's advocate and say, well, you just want to give in to evil, but it seems like, not giving in to them just made them more and more powerful. A bunch of 10,000s of people have died, and nobody even knows how many or probably really cares. And for what? You know, Robert Baer, the CIA guy, was on the show yesterday, and he said David Petraeus is a liar. He says they're making progress. They're doing anything toward their ostensible goals. Hogwash.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point that emerges from this story and the other stories that are linked with it over the past few years is precisely that the Taliban, the power, the rise of the Taliban in Afghanistan is a reflection of the grievances that have been generated by both the essentially abusive nature of the Afghan regime and the abusive nature of the foreign military occupation forces. And the more the foreign forces arrived in Afghanistan, the stronger the appeal of the Taliban was. And so, you know, this is a perfect example of how an insurgency arises because of the negative nature, the negative characteristics of the regime and its foreign supporters, its foreign protectors, not because of the internal nature of the insurgency itself.
Well, you think maybe that's the point, that they don't want to defeat an insurgency, they want to have one to fight? And so that's why fire the Iraqi army. That's why I refuse to accept reasonable terms from these guys way back when.
No, I don't think, again, there's a kind of conscious thought given to, yeah, let's let these people flourish so that we'll have a job to do. I think it's really a matter of the United States and NATO military establishments simply lacking the capability to do anything positive about the insurgency. I mean, they simply do not have the knowledge, the capability, the understanding to put into place policies that would have any chance of doing anything to cause the Taliban to lose support. In fact, everything they do virtually, I'm not saying, you know, literally everything, but almost everything they do has the opposite effect, simply because they're doing what they were trained to do, and what they were trained to do, what they're trained to do is not going to do any good. It's not going it's not going to help them to defeat the Taliban.
Well, and as you say in this article, you actually end this article with saying that from the very beginning, the Pakistani government was telling the Taliban to not give in, and they wanted a war, basically. They wanted an insurgency from the very beginning. And as everybody knows, that, you know, basically through this day, the Pakistanis have continued to support the Afghan Taliban. At the same time, they're fighting a civil war against the Pakistani Taliban on our behalf.
Yeah,
so
this is
solve that one for me.
This is a very important part of this story, which still...
You got a minute and a half. No, maybe two.
It still needs to be developed further. But I think the essence of it is this. In 2001, when the Bush administration decided it was going to go into Afghanistan, of course, it got the Pakistani government, Musharraf and his people, by the collar and said, you're going to cooperate with us or else. And, of course, Musharraf then went through the motions of doing that, but the basic policy of Pakistan never changed. I mean, they were determined that they were going to have a Taliban ally as long as possible to essentially put up a barrier to Indian influence there.
But how would they be so sure at that time already that whatever government America tried to install there would be, well, I guess they knew it would be the Northern Alliance coming to power, right?
They knew it would be Northern Alliance, and they also were very acutely aware that the Indians were quite actively involved in that period. I mean, they
from the very beginning.
Yes, and I mean, they had actual military personnel in Afghanistan. I've met one of them. And so this is a part of the story that is not well known at all. But the Pakistanis were playing a very, very clever two-sided game, a two-level game here with the United States throughout that period.
All right. Well, I'm sorry we're all out of time, but thank you very much for your time again on the show, Gareth.
Glad to talk as always, Scott.
Everybody, that's Gareth Porter. His new piece at antiwar.com is Evidence of 2002 Taliban Offer Damages Myth of Al-Qaeda Ties. And he's right. That title doesn't do it justice. Go check it out at antiwar.com/Porter. Another very important piece.